First, the iconic figure of Michael Collins, a man who knew the power of his own persona and capitalised on what people wanted to believe about him. The question of who he really was, of course, continues to fascinate people and perhaps to elude them as well. But for my first guest this evening, the willingness to see him as the sum of the Irish Revolution and in turn reduce him to a caricature of his many parts clouds our view of both the man and the revolution. I'm joined in studio by Dr. Anne Dolan of Trinity College Dublin and Dr. William Murphy of Dublin City University, and together they're the authors of a wonderful, beautiful new book, Michael Collins, The Man and the Revolution. You're both very, very welcome indeed.
Thank you.
Now, just first of all, and to get clear, this is not a straightforward biography of Michael Collins. I mean, when you go to page one, he's not in the cradle. Let's put it that way.
No, he isn't. I mean, I think there's been plenty of those ones to date, and in some ways I think that familiarity of that type of biography led us to try and approach it in a very different way. I mean, we didn't want to offer a single interpretation either. I think many of the existing biographies try and figure him out. I mean, Peter Hart's one, which is really excellent in many ways. I mean, even the fact it's called The Real Mick was moving towards this idea we'll find out who the real Mick was. And in some ways, I think we didn't want to solve him like a puzzle or take that type of definitive approach, because I think so much of what's interesting about him are the myths and the, if you like, the things people want to make him into. And I think for those reasons, we kind of went for a thematic approach, which I think still leaves people room and allows the reader to still ask questions at the end of it. And OK, we're looking at familiar themes like the sort of his role in the War of Independence, his you know, his work as a politician. But we're also sort of moving towards things that maybe are less familiar to try and prompt those new questions. So things like Collins and what he believed in, his Collins and celebrity, those types of things. Mm. And that, I think, as well, the other thing that was, I think we were really keen to include was, I suppose, a focus on the early part of his life, which in many ways often just gets mined in order to explain why he becomes the man he becomes. And actually, there's far more interesting things to be got from that period, not least, I suppose, the type of influences and experience he went through in London.
Yeah, London is crucial.
Absolutely.
And we'll come back
fundamental
and we'll
effect on him,
talk about London. Yeah. But I mean, I would have thought that no two people would ever agree on Michael Collins. Now, you have two people, therefore, who are involved in writing a book on Michael Collins. Did you agree on everything, William?
Oh, that's a good question. Did we agree on everything? I suppose we didn't necessarily have to agree on everything, given that one of the things we were interested in doing is presenting multiple versions of him and engaging with different aspects of his career. And when we set out to write the book, we had to ask ourselves the question, was it worth writing in the first place, given how many Michael Collins biographies there are? And we sat down and we chose the themes in part because they reflected the new material available, in part because they allowed us to reflect on some of the new literature that's come out over recent years about the Irish Revolution and put Collins in the context of those. But also they reflect our collective and separate interest, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So I have worked a lot on imprisonment and, you know, organisation, revolutionary organisation, on the relationship between sport and the revolution, for instance, whereas Anne had strengths in areas like violence and the revolution and commemoration and the revolution. So we could, you know, give each other a little bit of space, to be the key voice in the areas where we felt we had the greatest.
So you
strength.
Could sound each other out, but not necessarily, you know, you still could adopt your own particular viewpoint or perspective. And come back to London and the influence of the period that he spent in London. I mean, he didn't have a very long life.
No, I suppose.
You know, in the context of that life, he would have spent a long time in London, but in absolute terms, not very long at all.
Yeah, and I mean, it's really interesting because it's a very important time of any young person's life. It's the point at which they're starting to, and particularly someone who goes from a small place to this really exciting, very large city, and very exciting things are happening all around them. And I think one of the things that we benefit from in the book, and when you can see it, we've nearly 200 documents and photographs and all the rest of it, but he's someone who's in London at a time when, you know, the moving image is becoming important. Photography in newspapers is becoming important. And you can see him engaging at that time, even I think in notes he's writing on the back of minutes he has for his GAA club in London, where he's very aware of what's going on in Finland. And he's thinking about the wider world. He's thinking about new ideas. And he's been influenced by those, I think, in his thinking. And you can see that emerge in later life. But it's an exciting place for a young man to be.
He was also there when the suffrage movement was in its pomp. What would his attitude have been towards that? Because one of the great imponderables is, would things have been different for women in Ireland in the 1920s had Michael Collins survived?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no doubt that he's in favour of the vote for women, but his attitude towards women in terms of their role in public life seems to be quite limited. If you look at the people who he engaged with and who he trusts, and if he's got a political problem to work out, or if he's got, if he's facing an issue, it's men who are around him. It's men he trusts. That being said,
unless he's got a message that needs to be conveyed from point A
yes,
to point
absolutely.
B,
then
he's utterly reliant on women.
He works. Women work for him, I think, rather than him treating them as then with him. Mm-hmm. Now, women admire him greatly, and those who work with him are extremely loyal to him. So, for instance, one of the documents, which is one of my favourites in the book, is a letter from Mary Molly Woods in 1937.
This is about the bicycle.
This is about the bicycle, yeah.
Explain that.
Well, in 1937, she wrote to Piers Beasley, who was working on another edition of his biography of Collins at the time, and she informs him that back in 1920 or 21, Michael had needed to change the saddle on his bicycle, and she had decided to keep the saddle of the bicycle, and she had retained it all these years, and now she was considering whether the National Museum was the most appropriate place to send it.
Sounds like Flann O'Brien would have been the most appropriate person to send it to, the third policeman. Yeah.
But it's interesting, it shows how she regarded Collins, that even this small thing, his bicycle saddle, was not just worthy of her keeping, but she thought it was worthy of a place in the National Museum.
Because the great backside had sat upon said saddle. Now, he was a minor figure in 1916, and he goes from 0 to 60 in a very short period of time. So, I mean, to what extent was his involvement in 1916 part and parcel of that?
I mean, it is part and parcel of it, and in a way, he's established. He's there as aide-de-camp to Joseph Plunkett. He gets sent off to Frongoch. In a way, he establishes. He acquires the experience of the Rising that becomes incredibly important. I think, in a way, it's when he gets back, and I mean, it's those linkages with the prisoners. It's the linkages thereafter with the volunteers on the outside. It's particularly, I think, it's the importance of him becoming involved in the Irish National Aid and Volunteers Dependence Fund.
But go back to Frongoch, because he would not, I would have thought, he wouldn't have been by any manner of means the most senior volunteer in Frongoch. Yet he comes across as the kind of vice chancellor of Old Skull na Raibh Loggia in Frongoch. I mean, he more or less he appears to kind of to take it by the scruff of the neck.
I mean, he's very good at, and this is true of pretty much everything he gets involved in, he's very good at becoming someone who does hard work, takes on jobs that other people don't want to do. He's quite good at imposing himself on other people. I think there's probably he's one of those people who thinks that there's no job he couldn't do better himself. And in a way, he becomes a quite, enforceful kind of figure in Frongoch. Often, I think, there he gets enemies as well as friends because of that nature of his personality. Maybe he's someone who can rub people up the wrong way, and that becomes clear from Frongoch onwards. But at the same time, what also becomes clear from that point is just his willingness to take on just jobs that other people don't want to do.
And is it in Frongoch that the organisational skills come to the fore?
Yeah, I mean, they certainly do in Frongoch. Very early on, when he moves to London, for instance, you can see his aptitude for taking on administrative jobs and trying to control an organisation when he joins, for instance, the Geraldine's GAA club very early in London. And he immediately becomes, almost immediately becomes the secretary of that club. And there, that's the position. Anyone who knows a GAA club knows the secretary is the position where the real power lies. It's where you can network out of. You have to do all the nasty work, but at the same time, all the influence and power accumulates there. And inside Frongoch, again, he begins to do that. He becomes secretary to the prisoners inside Frongoch in the later period in the camp, particularly when conflict is emerging between the prisoners and the authorities. And he embraces that conflict with great gusto, partly because he thinks that's what should be done, but partly because the conflict is around conscription and the threat of conscription inside the camp, where, strange as it may seem, the British authorities thought it might be a good idea to conscript some of these Irish rebels out into the British army.
The British authorities do have some strange ideas, don't they?
And Collins was one of the people who would have been liable to that because he had lived in London for so long, right up to the introduction of conscription. And then when he comes out and he becomes Secretary of the Irish National Aid and Association Volunteer Dependence Fund, he's building networks with prisoners, he's building networks between prisoners, he's building networks out to the committees all around the country who are raising the funds and distributing the funds. And as soon as he has those networks in place, he's then beginning to utilise them for his other purposes. So himself and Michael Staines will try and use those branches to become the basis of the organisation of either Irish Volunteer branches or Sinn Féin branches. He's constantly double and triple jobbing to try and maximise both his influence and the resources he has created.
William said that he embraced conflict. And what about his embrace of violence?
I mean, he's someone who's, in some ways you could argue, he's quite pragmatic about it. He's famously known to have said that, you know, we won't have another Greek tragedy like the Easter Rising. And I mean, there's a number of ways you could read that, but he's someone who's quite prepared to get rid of awkward people, and that's something we see through the War of Independence. I mean, how much he's actually in control of the types of violence that go on then throughout the War of Independence is we could question that, certainly, how much control he has over what's happening in other counties outside of Dublin. It's very, very, very hard to know. And I think he admits that at various different times.
I mean, he supports Dan Breen and Sean Tracy, their action in Salahead Beg in January 1919, which I imagine must have been a great shock to a lot of people, including people in the volunteer movement.
Yes, but I think at the same time he's also aware of how much can they actually achieve at any given time. And I think one of the things he is, I suppose, kind of, it becomes clear within some of his letters right across the War of Independence period, he often sees violence as a way to draw more violence back on, if you like, the Irish volunteers, almost as a way to create a sense of greater sympathy, if you like, for the retaliation, if you like, in response to the retaliation, if that makes sense. That he sees, and in that sense, he's very pragmatic about this, because in a way, he's trying to keep people with this movement, if you like. You can't alienate people too much. So there's all this time, and again, it's all again back to how aware he was of propaganda, how wary he is of the media, and how the media is like liable to respond to various different acts. And you see this in some of the notes he writes at various different times, that, you know, certain thing has happened, and he says, "Oh well, we're in for a real crucifixion now," almost looking forward to it, because in a way that will then gain more public sympathy for the Irish case.
You must have figured that you weren't going to get out of the studio without being asked the old chestnut, and I'm going to pass it over to a member of the public, one of our listeners, so Ray in Kilkenny gets to ask the question. Rather than me. Was it ever known or discovered who shot Michael Collins nearly 100 years after his death?
Anne, maybe you want to talk about that.
I mean, there are, I think, over recent years, and I think certainly from a number of the previous biographies, I think, settled on Sonny O'Neill. I mean, I think there's another recent book has come out raising questions about that again. I think in some ways, the fact that he's dead is the key thing. The ambush, in a way, and all this curiosity about how he died maybe speaks to just the type of need we have for him to have died in a more spectacular way than he did.
Because he was the only casualty.
Yes,
isn't he?
I mean, I think there's a slight injury to one other person, but I mean, I think it even came up in, if you look at Neil Jordan's film diary, he talks about how worried Liam Neeson was that Collins dies in just this very straightforward, very sort of almost banal way, and how are we going to prepare a cinema audience for this? And I think in a way that is almost symbolic of that same urgency to make his death much more exciting and even conspiratorial than it was, and which I think says a lot about.
But Eamon De Valera was nowhere near it, in case you're wondering. The one of his personas, obviously, Will, is the intelligence chief. You know, he was Minister for Finance, but he's better known as the intelligence chief. And it's been said that, you know, he single-handedly destroyed the British Secret Service in Ireland. He can't have done that. But to what extent is it even vaguely true?
There's no doubt that he has a role in terms of the formation of the squad. There's no doubt he has a role when the Dublin Brigade are starting to first attacked the intelligence capacity of the Dublin Metropolitan Police in the summer of 1919, and again later on in the intelligence war more generally against the British. But he does that in connection with a whole series of other people, Mulcahy, Tobin, Thornton, who are all in many ways more involved, I think, in the day-to-day decisions and in the actual shooting than Collins is. I mean, Collins is involved in very, very little shooting himself. And part of that is, you know, these multiple roles again. Obviously, right through 1919, 1920, 1921, when a lot, particularly in 2021, when that violence is happening, Collins is Minister for Finance. He's managing the Dáil loan, which is extremely important. Important because it allows the creation of this counter, finances the creation of this counter state.
Yes. The Sinn Féin courts, the local government,
exactly.
And all of this.
And of course, it finances the guns with which these people are being killed, which is crucial, which is very important. But he's very clever again here as Minister for Finance in terms of the Dáil loan, in terms of how projecting himself in a modern way. There's a very interesting film which was made to promote the Dáil loan, and he is sitting, handing out bonds, taking the cheques, and the film says that he's doing this on the table which is where the beheading had taken place of one of the great Irish patriots, and he's harking back to this ancient patriotism, but also there's this modern, efficient bureaucracy going on, and also he's using modern technology to promote the movement.
This is the film that's taken round to cinemas around the country by the IRA, and it's suggested to the cinema owners that they might want to play this film or else.
Yes, absolutely. And then crucially, you're binding in the fourth element again, the violence there. So, you know, it's efficient organisation, it's politics, it's modern, but it also there's threat there too.
Yeah, but as a bureaucrat, I mean, he was a politician and he was Minister for Finance. Was he a good bureaucrat, Anne?
Yes, I mean, he's pretty capable in a number of these different roles, not least, and again, I think we see it in a lot of the documents we've reproduced in the book. He's constantly churning out paper, and lots of us constantly churn out paper, not to any great end, but he's in pretty considerable control of this paper as well. I mean, it's the notion of even the attempts at the types of bookkeeping he's trying to achieve through this period is quite striking in a way, given how underground it is, given the kind of danger that many of them are in at the time. And in many respects, I think you sometimes see there's a piece in one of Ernie O'Malley's memoirs where he talks about meeting Collins and coming up to see him. And throughout the entire time he speaks to Collins, Collins never stops writing and never stops sort of signing letters and doing
nowadays
these things.
Nowadays he'd be texting or something.
Possibly, like yes, yeah. So he's clearly someone who's very, very capable of conducting a conversation but continuing to do this at the same time. But, I mean, he's equally capable.
So unlike most men, he can multitask.
Absolutely, yes, of course. But I think there's one piece we have in the book, just this note, which it's unclear who he sends it to, but he just writes, "I told you so, Micheál." And in a way, you know, he can be a very good administrator, but equally there's that instinct in him which feels that, you know, he needs to send someone a letter like that, which is going to produce, you would imagine, a pretty negative effect.
One of the great things about the book is there are fabulous photographs. And, you know, Michael Collins of the War of Independence is stereotypically the man on the bicycle wearing a suit with a hat and a coat and, you know, trying to look as ordinary as possible. Then comes the Civil War. Now he's the man in the uniform. But he was never really a soldier, was he?
No, he was, and this emerges very clearly during the treaty debates, where this is an accusation thrown at him by many of those who are opposing the treaty and are accusing him of being a sellout. And they're saying, you have been represented as the man who won the war. There's this, really, you are a myth. You know, you're pretending to be a soldier now. You've pretended to be a soldier all along, but really it was people like us in Tipperary and in Cork who did the hard work, who won this war. And there's a real sense for some of them that Collins the soldier is a charlatan.
But he can't bring them with him, because I think about two thirds of the volunteers go anti-treaty.
Yeah, absolutely. That said, one of the organisations where he can clearly wield a lot of influence is the Irish Republican Brotherhood.
Yes.
And he's very successful in bringing large swathes of the Irish Republican Brotherhood with him. Mm. And these are people who are apparently the most ideological Republicans inside the movement. And yes, they're prepared to follow Collins and support the treaty. And again, in part, that I think reflects how good a politician he is in the committee room. As the negotiations are going on towards the treaty, he is constantly preparing the IRB for the compromise which is to come, so that when it arrives, they're ready for it and they're willing to accept it. Whereas I think you have a problem in Ireland at that stage where there were large swathes of the country who hadn't been prepared for the compromise which was to follow.
Finally, Anne, was he conscious of his own image? Was he conscious of his own iconic status, and did he promote that?
He's very conscious of it. I mean, at one point he writes to De Valera and says to him, you know, I hope you read about that escape I had last week. It's nothing on the one I had the week before. And he's very, very conscious of the press coverage, and even and particularly some of the British press coverage. And in ways, it's no harm, I think, for him that he is being perceived in that particular way. And he uses that image to his advantage. Even when he goes to London, he stays a day behind the rest of the delegation. And you can see even the response, if you look at the British press, that he's the one they're waiting to see. And this,
but is he conscious that the Irish people really at this stage need some kind of a Superman type figure in terms of morale?
I think he does, because there's a number of his own, I mean, there's a number of volunteers write to him at various different stages saying, you know, if you're caught, we're lost. You're the only one who matters. He's getting these kind of letters. Even when he's over in London, he's sending home death threats and saying to sort of Desmond Fitzgerald at home, get those put in the paper. I think he knows exactly what his value is in that way. And, you know, he even talks about some of the more sort of outrageous stories that are in the British press about him. So he's keeping an eye on what the popular British press are saying about him all the way along, which again, maybe gets us back to where we started. He's very conscious of how that press works from his time in London. He knows exactly how to use his own persona and to use it very carefully.
William Murphy and Dolan, thank you both very much indeed for joining us. The book is called Michael Collins, The Man and the Revolution. Beautifully illustrated hardback book by, appropriately enough, I suppose, the Collins Press. Thank you very much again for joining us.